Did you actually see one for yourself, or did you read about it? What was your first access to this possibility?
I went to a playground called Possibilities Playground in Port Washington, and I fell in love with it. I saw children with disabilities and without disabilities playing side by side. I saw how uniquely it was designed, and I called the spearhead, the woman that inspired that project, and I started taking notes and doing research, and I went around to some other playgrounds to see just how accessible they are, and I went to Oconomowoc, and I went to the Imagination Station, and it was the same thing. I saw the same thing, so I thought, well, if they did it in their communities, we can do it in ours.
And here's the proof of it, what we see before us. So this is 3 years ago. So sketch for us what the timeline has been, and for this company that creates these playgrounds, I mean, do they sort of prescribe the timeline for you? Is there a sort of prescribed way to get this done?
Each build is unique, and it's based on funding, and sometimes it's a three-year project, sometimes it's a four-year project. There's no set standard of time. It depends on how much money you want to raise, what your goals are, and how quickly you get there, and how big your playground is going to be, and how many high-ticket items you have on it. So that kind of designates your timeline for you.
Right. So did you raise as much money as you could, and then that made those choices for you, or did you aim high? Did you make choices of the size of the playground and how big you wanted it to be and what it would offer, and then raise the money to make it possible?
Well, if you're going to dream, you got to dream big. And so we went big. We went for the $1 million price tag, and we kind of knew how big we wanted it. We kind of had an idea how much equipment we wanted. So we just kind of put the two and two together and started making a list with some price tags and went on from there. So
what was the point at which you could begin the build? I mean, what had to be in place? A certain amount of money?
A certain amount of money, and then a certain commitment from the community. And we planned this build for a very long time. So we started raising the money. We worked through the design phase. We actually designed the playground, and then we continued to raise the funds. And then we really educated and advocated and got the community to embrace the vision. And once we got the community to embrace the vision, that's when we started moving a little quicker.
Explain what this land is that we're standing on.
This is Petsky Park, and Petsky Park originally was used for a lot of baseball. Traditionally, there was a lot of baseball going on here, and this was the old McWhite tire and rope manufacturing building.
A long time ago.
So they came in and they did some parking lots. They made some parking lots, and Carthage College made some rugby and some soccer fields over there. And then the bathroom, that became another phase that was done here at Petsky. And then the playground is another phase of a phased out project.
Right. So one of the things we, of course, want to talk about is the actual building that is taking place here and this small army of volunteers that is making this possible. First of all, talk about what kind of numbers we're talking about in terms of the number of volunteers that are necessary for a project like this.
We have about 300 volunteers coming out per day, and then we also have about 30-35 support staff. So I would say in a given day, probably 1,000 people, and it's a 10-day build. So we believe that we're going to touch the lives of about 3,000, maybe between 3,000 and 3,500 different people are involved in the build in some way. We even have restaurants, churches, taverns who have donated all the food. So while the volunteers are here, they're being fed. And there's about 70 restaurants that have donated all the food for the entire build.
Wow. So you were mentioning before we went on the air that let's call them local celebrities, if we want to call our elected officials celebrities, have been part of this effort. You want to give us a sense of some of those luminaries who've been part of this?
Actually, I think maybe my co-coordinator Scott he's got a better memory than I do. Maybe he can name some of the people that have come out that we've seen out here the last couple days.
Well, we have seen right now 14 of the 17 members of the Kenosha City Council here. We've seen county board executives here. The president of the village of Pleasant Prairie, John Steinbrink, was here. Former Mayor John Antoranium, State Rep Todd Onstead is on site today as we speak. So many members of the community, just not elected officials, but sure. former elected officials, a contingent of 21 members of the Kenosha Police Department were here a couple days ago that took vacation days or were on their off time to come show up. High school football teams from Westosha, the whole varsity team showed up after 3 hours of practice.
Wow.
The St. Joe's cheerleaders are coming today, not to cheer, but to work. And to see this community build, truly, it is building a community. There's no other way to describe the movement that has happened here on the site.
People are coming back. They work 4 hours, they'll come back, they'll work another 4 hours, and then they'll work another 4 hours. And before you know it, they've been here 12 hours. And then they're not signed up for the next day, and we see them again. It's become almost contagious.
And even on a very rainy day, as our listeners all know, a pretty ferocious thunderstorm went through, and it's a wet, soggy place, but the place is still alive with activity. So it doesn't look like too many of your volunteers have been scared off by the weather.
No, we're actually encouraging some specialized, skilled tradesmen to come out. We need a little bit higher skill level, people that can run circular saws and people that can run miter saws. So we're really in need of carpenters, skilled carpenters, to come out and give us whatever they can give us between either today or tomorrow, which is Saturday. We have about 21, 22 hours left of our community build. So we don't want people to miss their once in a lifetime opportunity to participate in a $1 million playground. This is a once in a lifetime opportunity.
Very well put. So we have a real variety of people here. And of course, there's, you have probably some volunteers who've never done anything like this in their lives at all. Explain kind of the logistics of how that works. If a willing volunteer steps forward, but has never done anything like this before, what kind of training do they get? What kind of supervision do they get?
Well, Greg, when we say we have a job for everyone, we mean everyone. This process is broken down in a way that if a construction crew came out and did this, they could probably knock it out in 2.5 days. But we break this down to very simple steps, and a person who doesn't have skills will be taught and shown and mentored to get this to work. And it really does work. We have a process over in our tent right now going on where one person will mark the hole, the next person will drill the hole, the next person will take the picket off, the next person will put one on, and it's like a production line. And really, when we say there's a job for everyone, that is no joke. There is a job for everyone. And I'm not skilled. I'm the first one that, I don't know how to use a power tool, so I was out there with a wheelbarrow picking up scraps. I mean, there really is a job for him. You just got to want to come, you got to want to help, and you want to be part of history.
Right. You were mentioning something about how there has to be some kind of coordination, too, because certain things have to happen, certain things have to get built or put in place before the next thing can happen. So how does that work, the sort of the unfolding of the various stages?
Well, our design team of Play by Design of Ithaca, New York, under the guidance of Lee Archin, who's on site today, has a master plan. And he delegates that plan out to his two co-workers that are here, who will delegate it out to our build captains, who are volunteers, who will be here for 13 hours today and every day. And then they will delegate it out to their crews. And it goes right downhill. And there's a check and balance system. The work is always checked. And when people come out and they work and they see this product, you're not going to be able to really tell that this was built by inexperienced volunteers. You're going to say, oh my God, look at that thing. It just popped out of the sky. It just dropped in. And it was built professionally. And it will be safety inspected. It's a regular playground that's a very special piece of history now in our city.
Right. And it's massive. I mean, one of the best reasons to come besides helping is to just see it with your own eyes. It's an incredible sight to see. So Tammy, this is a 10-day build. What did it look like on day one? What happened on the first day?
Day one, there was excavated holes in the ground. There was hundreds and hundreds of holes in the ground. You could hardly walk without a hole in the ground, and at different depths. And then the holes became posts in the ground, and there was posts sticking up all over. They looked like Lincoln logs. And then from there, they started getting straight. And then from there, they got a frame. And then from there, they got a footing. So it was just one thing after another. And if you blinked your eye, something else was happening out there. It was incredible.
So tell us what is special in terms of accessibility about this playground, the sort of features it has that makes it a very special place for certain kids who would not be able to access a more normal playground.
I would have to say the most accessible item we have out there is our rubber flooring. It's our highest ticket item, but it truly ensures that people of all abilities can be on it. Not only children with disabilities, but grandparents that have typically developing grandchildren will be able to safely navigate, and also veterans who may be may have lost a limb will be able to navigate. So I would say the floor is our number one barrier reducing item. We also have a wheelchair accessible merry-go-round for those children who are bound to their wheelchair, where they actually will be on there and it'll swing with them inside their wheelchair. Very high ticket item, but worth every penny. We also have a wheelchair accessible merry-go-round with the same thing, where the wheelchair goes on the merry-go-round and the children have shoulder to shoulder play. There's no division where, well, if you have a disability, you play over here, and you don't have a disability, so you play over there. This playground was designed for shoulder to shoulder play.
That's great. So you don't have kids with special needs sitting on the sidelines watching other kids play.
Not anymore.
Everybody gets to be part of this. Scott, how long are the work days? I mean, how early do you begin and how late do you go into the afternoon or evening?
Well, this morning we ramped up at 8 o'clock and we will go till at least 8:30 tonight. We have lighting when it gets dark that we light up the site. Tomorrow, which is the last day of the build, we will go 8 to 4:30. And so the pressure is on. The pressure's on here, but we'll get it done. You know, Tammy talked about the swing. And last night we brought Amity Foresight, who's really been the inspiration of this whole project, onto the site to be the test pilot for the wheelchair swing.
Oh.
We stopped the build for about 5 minutes and we put Amity on that swing. And to see that swing work made this 3 years that Tim and I and others have put our heart and souls into, to see that the joy on that child's face just made it all worthwhile, no doubt. And people can see that on our Facebook page and take a look at it and you'll understand what we're talking about.
Very good. Well, again, we've been saying, we are broadcasting live from the construction site of the new Dream Playground on the north side of Kenosha. And we're going to break away for a few minutes and gather up some other volunteers and coordinators who have also played an essential role in making all of this a possibility. So, Tammy, we're going to reconnect, and Scott as well. And I know you're going to gather up some other folks that we can talk to keep telling this amazing story of the Dream Playground. Before we go, Tammy, I want you to reiterate your call for skilled volunteers that are really needed today and tomorrow.
Yes, please come out and give us some 4 hours, 8 hours, or 12 hours of your time. We need skilled workers who can run a miter saw and who can run a circular saw and make some intricate cuts, miter cuts. And we need people to just come out and do what they can do and make this dream become a reality for people of all ability.
And we are back at the construction site of the Dream Playground on the north side of Kenosha. And I'm Gregory Berg and thrilled to be here to see this amazing thing take shape. And we're going to talk to a few of the coordinators who have played a really crucial role in making this possible. One of them is Sharon Molinaro, who is the Art and Special Effects Coordinator for this project. And she is anxious to get to some very important painting. Sharon, explain what your responsibilities are.
My responsibilities are to make the playground look beautiful with the embellishments of, we have two 18-foot mosaics. I have a 13 by 12-foot mural that I'm painting myself, and painting all the lighthouses and whatever else needs to be painted or stained.
So it's colorful and beautiful. The mural that I was shown was especially beautiful, in particular how it's made and what it depicts.
Yes, we've been working on both of those since January. The stained glass one of the little kids. A friend of mine, Moni, she put the little kids together, and a bunch of other artists and I put all the glass around it to make it look beautiful. And then the fish mosaic, we had the Bradford High School art students, they made fish for me, clay fish. And we put those up on the wall, and we put cracked tiles around them, so it looks beautiful.
It really does look gorgeous. Now tell us why you're so anxious to get out of here. You have a very important painting project to get started on.
There's a crane coming to put the tops on the buildings, and I have to have them all painted and the top of the lighthouse painted before they come at noon to put them up.
Well then, Sharon Molinar, we're going to let you go. Thanks. Thanks so much. All your work here.
All right.
I've seen several people I know here on site among the hundreds of people that are working very hard today. And hey, Carol, another one. We're talking right now with John Tedding, whom some of you probably know for many years at Snap-on. And John Tedding is the tools coordinator for this project. And it sounds like that has involved quite a lot of time for you. How long have you been part of this?
Been working on this since October of 2014 when I was asked to get all of the tools necessary to build a playground in a week and a half. My counterpart, Pat DeGrace, the materials coordinator, got all of the plastic lumber, all of the screws, over 2,000 pounds of just screws alone. And the two of us have been working hand in hand since about April. A lot of hours, but a very, very, very great cause.
Explain why Pat is not on the microphone right now. What is he frantically busy with right now?
Well, as most of you are probably aware, we had a considerable amount of rain this morning, and the two of us have been using sump pumps to pump out the holes because we got to have a truckload of cement coming around 9 o'clock, and we need to get all the holes pumped.
So you were pointing out these two impressive-looking trailers, and they are absolutely full of tools. So give us a sense of the array of tools that are necessary for this project and where they've come from.
First of all, I have to give a lot of credit to our construction companies in town, to Riley Construction, Rash, Bain Nelson, and Camozzi, then to Snap-on, but most importantly to one individual, Tom Reihizer from the trades unions, and another, Roger Clark, who helped coordinate more than 18 skill saws, jigsaws, 20 of those, chainsaws. Snap-on was a tremendous donor, donated over $60,000 of cordless drills and cordless screwdrivers and all sorts of tools that are being used on the project. So,
and I suppose you as coordinator, one of the things you have to do is keep track of them, keep track of where they are, where they're being used, and make sure they get back to the people who have donated them.
Greg, you might be surprised, but we decided not to make people check things out. So when they come for something in the morning, it's a total honor system. This is our second build. We're on our eight and a half day. We have not lost so much as maybe a couple of pencils here and there. So what we do, check in the expensive stuff at night. We leave things on site, but Schmidt Security and the Kenosha Police Department have been very gracious in helping us make sure that the site is kept safe.
Very good. So it's on track as far as you can tell. This is going to finish on time?
I care not to comment because one of the proprietary information pieces that Play by Design holds to is the fact that they are the ones that design, they are the ones that tell us how to build. So all we know from day to day is pretty much what they're working on. So I'm not going to comment on
right.
that.
Well, it's looking impressive. It looks like it's getting close. And I suppose we've had some days here that have not been especially kind to the volunteers, but it doesn't sound like they've been scared away by heat or rain or anything.
Well, there's been a few times where we've been putting 20 by 30 foot tarps up over the eating areas. We've had people in there due to inclement weather. We, of course, would pull them off if the weather was too bad or there was lightning. But we've kept working when it's just raining on, well, it was the third day today, so that it's rained this week. So,
got to feel good to be a big part of this.
It definitely does. It definitely does. We'll be happy when it's over, but the camaraderie from all of the people that are here has just been fantastic. And a community support, if you're out there and if you still can give us some time today or tomorrow, we'd be happy to have you here, unskilled or skilled.
Great. John Tedding, thank you so much. Thanks for being part of this. We're broadcasting live from the construction site of the Dream Playground on the north side of Kenosha. Katie Briggs is joining me now, and she is the volunteer coordinator, or one of them, and you...
The volunteer coordinator.
Holy cow, I can't imagine one person shouldering a responsibility like that. What has that meant? What kinds of... what have you been busy doing?
Oh, I have made so many contacts with so many different businesses and organizations. They've either contacted me or I've gone out and reached out to them. I've gone to multiple meetings for carpenters unions and the builders trade associations and recruited them to also recruit volunteers, which has been a major help.
So explain kind of the process when a volunteer shows up here on site. Dave Cole and I from the radio station had experienced a little bit of that, actually, even ourselves, just coming on the site. You want everybody to be safe and know what's going on. Typically, when a volunteer comes, what do they do?
Safety is our number one priority. So prior to anyone even coming onto the build site, they have to check in at the volunteer table where volunteers are getting down their name, their information. They're getting a name tag. No one enters the site without a name tag, and they're signing liability waivers. And then to get volunteers out onto the build site, we're basing them on their skill level, where we're taking a skilled worker and putting them with a couple willing workers. And then we're escorting them out to the site so that they get a task right away and can start working and dive into what it is that they should be doing.
So what are the numbers we're talking about? How many volunteers have been part of this?
During phase one in August, we had about 65 volunteers per shift just working on the actual build site. So that doesn't include any of the support staff. And then here in September, during the second phase, we've had over 100 volunteers per shift on the actual build site. We have a lot of walk-ons that just, you know, they drove past, they saw it, or they came back one day and they want to keep coming back and helping the next day.
Wow, that has to make you feel so good. I mean, the spirit here is electrifying.
It is unbelievable. Everybody leaves with a smile on their face. It's, you may not know someone when you start to work with them, but you feel like their best friend by the time you are done because you just work so close and you get along so well. Everybody is smiling. The atmosphere is so light and fun.
Even on a stormy Friday morning. Katie Briggs, thanks for all that you've done about this, and thanks for joining us on the morning show.
Oh,
great
you.
To talk to you. Tammy, is this the food lady behind you?
Judy Kinkowski.
So you're keeping Jinkowski. You've kept everybody well fed on site. Tell us what's been involved in making that possible.
Well, we've been working on it since last December. We fed probably close to 3,500 individual meals to the volunteers. We are feeding breakfast, lunch, and dinner. The breakfasts are for the team captains. Lunch and dinner is for any volunteers that are on site at the time, between 100 and 200 at any given meal. All of our food, well, I would say 95% of our food, has been donated by local businesses. We're amazed at the way the local businesses have stepped up to support not only the food, but everything as far as the playground goes. But
right. Tammy was saying, I think, something like 70 restaurants have donated food?
70 businesses.
Okay.
Some of them are churches, some of them are restaurants, and some of them are catering places,
okay.
And then some civic groups also have contributed. So every day we feed them breakfast, lunch, dinner. We also provide thousands of snacks for them. Those have all been donated. Water. We have water here for them all day long. We keep it cold, so we have to get ice shipped in every day, four or five times a day. It's a big undertaking.
Wow.
Big undertaking.
Have you done something like this before? I mean, do you have some experience with feeding 5,000?
No, I actually didn't even do that good of a job just feeding a family of three, I'm going to tell you right now.
Well, you're doing a great job with this. Judy Jinkowski, great to meet you, and thanks for all the work that you've done here.
Thank you.
Great, great, great. Well, Scott Gordon, you're here. Looks like Tammy Conforti is busy on the phone. Who knows what she might be dealing with. In the last couple of minutes or so, give us a sense of what remains to be done. I mean, actually, if you stand here, you know it's a playground. I mean, it's already taken shape to an impressive degree, but there is work to be done. Give us the 60-second summary of what remains to be done here at the Dream Playground.
We're going to be installing about 1,500 fence pickets today with a crew. Those are the ones that people made a donation and got their engravement on them. We're going to have a big crane coming in here at 12 o'clock to make four big lifts on the top of the roofs, which will be something that's really going to be unique and fun to see. We're going to have site cleanup going on. We've got a lot of fine tuning work to be done, a lot of railings to be put up. We'll be hanging our swings, really just unwrapping our slides, a little bit of everything today. But with 100 volunteers here, it's going to go very quickly, but we do need more. So if you're skilled, if you're a carpenter, you're a plumber, you're a construction person, come on down. We will find a job for you today, Greg.
Tell them exactly where they should go.
They'll come to Petsky Park, which if you put in the coordinates on your GPS of 29th Street and 14th Avenue, you will see the playground right here. It's the old McWhite manufacturing site for those that have been in this town a long, long time.
Absolutely. Scott Gordon, you've been a big, big part of this, and we thank you for all that you've done on behalf of the Dream Playground, and thanks for being part of the morning show today.
Thanks so much, Greg. Got to get back to work.
Okay, you do that. Tammy, do you have a final word for us for just a second? Before we turn things back to our studios, maybe a word of thanks to everybody who's made this possible.
Oh my gosh, we live in such a generous community. This speaks volumes for the community in which we live, for people to come out and donate their most precious resource, which is their time.
And Tammy Conforti, thanks for all the time you've given to this as well. Thanks so much. It's an amazing thing. I hope a lot of people will come out to enjoy it for years to come.
Thank you.
We turn things back to WGTD News Director Dave McGrath. I'm Gregory Berg.
Thank you, Gregory. And for this next portion of the WGTD Morning Show, we're previewing for you a two-part American Experience documentary about one of the most influential visionaries of the 20th century, Walt Disney. It'll air on Monday and Tuesday evenings of next week on PBS. Greg Berg spoke with Sarah Colt, director and producer for the program. She's got some past credits with American Experience, including a remarkable documentary she did on auto magnate Henry Ford. One of the most remarkable things about the documentary is the extraordinary access which the filmmakers were granted to the vast archives of the Walt Disney Company.
I think we were just, I have to say, throughout the entire project, I was kind of pinching myself and had my moments when I worried, do they really know what they've done? Are they really going to let us do this? And they, you know, to their credit, from beginning to end, they gave us the access that they said they would. And we are, very grateful to that access to the archives, because as you might know, really most of the Disney material, not only the collection, all of his films and his classic films obviously are owned by the company, but also his image and the still photographs and the footage of him, sort of the behind-the-scenes footage, is, I would say, 95% of it is owned by the company. So without their agreement, we wouldn't have been able to do the project. Mm.
I think you do an especially beautiful job of helping us understand, in a sense, the inner personal hunger in Mr. Disney himself, in wanting to forge the kind of entertainment that he did, and ultimately to create these wonderful places like Disneyland and Disney World, a hunger that seems to be deeply rooted in what he experienced in his own childhood, both positive things and also some very real pain, most of it involved with his own father, Elias. Talk about that personal side of the Walt Disney story and the challenge of trying to reveal that to us so authentically as you did.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think that really was the key to the film, was to try to get close to this man who, for most people, really is legendary. And for, I think, later generations, they may not even know he was a man, that, you know, the name Walt Disney has become a brand, and they don't even realize that there is a person behind this empire as, you know, as we know it today. And, you know, it was really important to me to get to know him, and that's really kind of the process of doing a biography, and it isn't always easy. And I would say that Walt Disney was a person that I think kept people somewhat at arm's length, so really trying to understand him and get inside his head was the challenge. And I do think that his childhood, as you say, was critical to who he became as a person, as it is for most of us. And it was, he had a fairly tough childhood. His father was a very hard man and expected his children to work extremely hard. And he wasn't a lot of fun, Elias Disney. He wasn't very interested in jokes. He didn't like jokes. And his son, Walt, who was the youngest of the boys, so there were four boys and then a fifth child who was a girl, Walt was fun and extroverted and full of laughter and full of jokes and loved to dress up and, in fact, wanted to be an actor. And he was sort of in, you know, did he develop that personality in opposition to his father? Maybe so. You know, it's always hard to know where a personality comes from. But that was a huge part of who he was growing up and growing to be different from this very hard man who was his father.
At one point, someone in the film says it would be hard to find a father and son more different from each other. I thought that was an intriguing way to put it.
Yes. And that, you know, Neil Gabler, who is the biographer, one of Disney, the main biographer for Walt Disney, and spent 6 years in the archives, and he also had unprecedented access. He has been tremendously helpful to my process, because he really knows Walt Disney backwards and forwards. Hmm. And that's what he says in the film.
You tell us about him going to work for an ad agency, but in his spare time going to the movies and just being captivated by this still relatively new art form. And he puts together something, his own little company, to start creating little animated shorts. And this first really major effort on his part really ends disastrously when the whatever outfit of theaters or whoever it was that hired him to create these films stiffed him, that is, refused to pay him for what had been created. And I'm so glad that you share this story, because it probably helps us understand why Walt Disney ended up becoming kind of the businessman that he was from that point on, that with that really painful experience of being just so mistreated, probably is one reason why he wanted control from that point on.
Well, and I also think what's so interesting is that in the, you know, Disney really was a visionary. I definitely think he was entrepreneurial, and he had that confidence to go out and say, my ideas are worthwhile and I'm going to just keep trying them. But in the end, I don't think he was a terribly good businessman. And I think that, you know, after that terrible failure in Kansas City, he goes to Hollywood and he teams up with his brother Roy. And Roy is an absolutely fundamental part of the success of the Disney company, because Roy does have a sense of business and is very practical and pragmatic. And so they really complement each other, these brothers. And, you know, Disney, the company, would never have existed without Walt Disney, but he did need his brother. He needed that person to ground him and to go out and raise money and help him to fund these projects that he wanted to do, because he wasn't, as I say, I really don't think he was entrepreneurial, but I'm not sure he really had a good sense of business at all times. And he got himself into trouble when he was sort of left to his own devices.
Well, that helps us also understand why, although we think of Walt Disney's experience as just sort of one spectacular success after another, in fact, there are all kinds of really significant setbacks again and again and again. And even in what we think of as the golden age of his films, which of course begin with Snow White and proceed with other masterpieces right after that, that one film after another, in fact, lost money because the costs were so high and so on. The fact that in so many ways your film is about the rub between Walt Disney, the extravagant visionary, and the pragmatic brother Roy, trying to hem him in and stick to the budget and have sort of a realistic feet on the ground. I mean, that's such an interesting mix. It's what made them ultimately successful, but it's also one reason why things were not easy.
And that's one of, I think, the revelations in a way of really examining his life, is that it would be easy to think that the Disney company was always wildly successful and rolling in money, and it's just not true. They worried about money. They were often going over budget. They were taking loans from Bank of America, and they really never had the money that Disney wanted to fund his projects. Now, they did make big, big money off of Snow White, and that was a huge financial success and very, very exciting. But what Walt Disney did with that money is what he always did with money. He poured it back into the projects that he wanted to do. So he immediately takes this enormous pile of money and he builds a new studio and starts, continues working on these very, very ambitious feature-length films, Pinocchio, Bambi, and Fantasia. And he basically runs through that money very, very quickly, because he just puts it all back into his ideas and his vision. So I think that's a really kind of surprising part of the story. It really isn't until the success of Disneyland that the studio is on solid ground financially.
I appreciate that we see so much of his work even ahead of Snow White, which is, I think, 1937. And that, for instance, somewhere you were able to dig up one of these Laugh-O-Gram cartoons that Walt Disney was never paid for, but somehow that scratchy old footage still exists. And some of these wonderful films that he made involving a little girl named Alice, in which we see a combination of live footage and animation in some groundbreaking ways. Just say a word about the excavation that was involved in bringing some of this tremendously rare footage to the screen for us to enjoy.
Well, this was a big research project, as you might imagine. And, you know, the research began as soon as we got the green light from the Disney company. And while most of the material does come from the Disney company, we had some exciting finds outside of the company with private collectors. And, for example, there's a piece of footage that we use, or several pieces of footage that we use in the film that were shot by an animator who worked with Walt Disney. And that film was sitting in a box in his widow's house in Hollywood and had not been seen for a long time. And it took months and months to find that box of material, which we had we knew it existed, but we didn't know where the master material was. So that was, those kinds of finds are always so gratifying and very exciting. With the early Disney movies, some of them are still owned by the company, but the company is quite spread out in terms of where they have things housed. So it's all there, but it is also kind of a detective job to find out in which sort of arm and which part of the company the different films exist. We use a footage from an Oswald short, and that was Disney's character right before he came up with Mickey Mouse. And that film had actually just been discovered in Germany, and the Disney company had found it, and they had just restored it. So it's very exciting for us to use some of those materials that people have really not seen since they first premiered way, way back in in the 20s.
We're speaking with Sarah Colt, who is director and producer of a really marvelously crafted documentary, a two-part documentary for American Experience on Walt Disney. I knew a fair amount about Walt Disney and his life and career before I watched your film, and yet I learned an enormous amount. One story that I didn't really know anything about was how Walt Disney, as his company finally began to take off and enjoy success, how Walt Disney needed to expand and created for his employees a really amazing facility in which it was, in some ways, almost a self-contained community. And in some ways, there was no need to go home because of all that was there. And, of course, it in some ways feels like a precursor for some of the other things he envisioned, like Disneyland and Disney World and Epcot and so on. Just say a word about this particular facility and the way in which it represented some of the extraordinary growth which eventually the Walt Disney Company enjoyed.
Well, it's really interesting because I think Disney saw his studio as this kind of utopian place. That's what he wanted it to be. He wanted it to be a place where people could be creative and they could experiment and they could fulfill his vision. So everyone was in service to him, but he did want to create a very exciting and dynamic workplace. And when they made Snow White, they were bursting out of a facility on Hyperion Avenue. So they were renting apartments and they were building additions, but it was just getting so cramped and crowded that when he made all the money off of Snow White, he was just very excited about expansion and building the perfect studio. So he wanted the buildings to reflect this utopian idea that he had of what his studio could be. And he built this beautiful studio, and it's still there today, and that's where the archives are, and I was able to go there a number of times for this project. And it feels like sort of a perfect Southern California college campus. Now, the sort of sad thing in some ways is that they get to the new studio, which Disney has designed. You know, he's worked very closely with the architects and the designers, and he's spent all this money. And something changes when they get there because the company has grown. And there's something sort of more mechanical, more almost industrial about what he's built. You know, he's trying to build this utopian place, and in some ways by building it, he's losing something, which is kind of an age-old story about growth and how do you keep a company, you know, small and family feeling. You know, he really loved that family feeling that his studio had. And when he moves to Burbank, it kind of starts to go away. And that's a problem. It becomes a big problem and leads to this very important turning point in his career and in his life, which was the strike by the animators in his company in 1941.
One thing that's interesting to me is that part one of your program ends and part two begins with this strike. And I suspect that that isn't just luck that, well, we kind of reached the halfway point of all the things we want to talk about. But I suspect that there was more to it than that. Explain why this was, in a sense, a good fulcrum in which to craft your documentary.
Well, it was really clear right from the beginning for me when I was doing my initial research on this project and reading the biographies and books about Walt Disney that the strike was absolutely fundamental to his life experience. It was transformative. And transformative moments are always important moments when you're thinking about biography. And so it really was, there was no question in my mind that the strike was key and very dramatic and very important to understanding Walt Disney. And so in making a four-hour series, it was just obvious that the strike had to be this turning point between the first half of his career and then the second half that really is influenced so heavily by what happens in the strike. You know, the strike really is the moment when Disney, you know, he may have brought on the strike. You know, there were lots of things he did that created the problems that led to the strike, so he's absolutely not blameless in the strike. But if you're thinking about him and his story, the strike for him was this terrible moment of betrayal, and he feels so betrayed and so hurt by the fact that these men who he thought, you know, loved him, and he thought that he was being a father figure to them, the notion that they would go on strike against him, he couldn't understand it, and it made him very unhappy, and it really changed the course of his career and how he saw the studio and where he went next.
Right. And one thing I have to say is there is a moment in the film when Walt Disney has gathered some of his unhappy employees in an auditorium and is speaking to them. And he really actually lectures them. He is not conciliatory at all. And your film tells us that most of the employees walked out of there absolutely furious, which is really what precipitated this full-fledged strike then to occur. And we hear that. I mean, somebody recorded that, and that moment is it puts us right there in the heart of the tension. It's fascinating.
Well, and this is where it was so much fun from my perspective as a filmmaker. I mean, can you believe that there's actually audio of that speech? I mean, it's a dream come true. And the reason there's audio is because Disney was told by his lawyers that he needed to record the statement he was making to his employees so that there would be no misinterpretation of what he said. So that was recorded by him and is in the Disney archive. And again, we were unbelievably lucky to have access to things like that within the archive. So that was, you know, that's the kind of thing which just makes you, as a filmmaker, the most exciting moments.
Absolutely.
It's just so great.
Incredible. Well, as your film tells us, of course, he goes on to, with the help of Roy, actually, really, ultimately these issues are resolved. The company is back in business, and they go on to some further successes, explore television, and, of course, the creation of Disneyland and later Disney World. I mean, it's an amazing story. One of the things I so appreciate is that your film, for the attention that it gives, as it should, on these moments of controversy, also help us celebrate the extraordinary artistic legacy of Walt Disney, who didn't want to just entertain, but wanted to inspire and uplift and create beautiful art. In particular, I think when you guys describe what was achieved in a film like Bambi, one of the analysts talks about how extraordinary it was that an audience would be made to cry by what they know are just drawings on a screen. They know there really isn't this deer and its mother that gets shot by this hunter. It's all drawings. And yet those drawings are so beautifully done, wed to such a moving story, that we find ourselves unable to do anything but cry. I mean, the power of that. And it's just one facet of his extraordinary artistic achievement.
Yeah, I think that, you know, those five classic Disney films, Snow White, Pinocchio, Fantasia, Bambi, and Dumbo, you know, everyone should go back and watch them again if they've forgotten them, you know, if they haven't seen them since they were a child, because they are very impressive films, and they explore some very deep and important psychological and emotional things, and it's really pretty you know, that's where he, I think, his real genius is was his ability to really kind of take a medium and expand it and really almost invent a new medium out of animation with color and the multiplane camera and all this technology that he brought to bear, but then also his storytelling and his willingness and ability to tell a story.
Well, and his insistence on sparing, yeah, and his insistence on sparing no expense, even though it was such a gigantic undertaking. Glacial progress is said at one point in terms of what it took to form these extraordinary films. But of course, the rest is history.
Right.
This documentary, again, is called Walt Disney, and it will air next week as part of PBS's series American Experience. Sarah Colt, its director and producer. Sarah Colt, congratulations. This film is a masterpiece. I am so glad I could talk with you about it. Congratulations on this great achievement.
Thank you so much. This has been a real pleasure. Lots of fun for me.